Oh my God, this thing says it's raining beer in Buffalo. What the hell is going on?
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 63 of The Glory and the Power That Is Bad Voltage. We are coming to you from the substrate of the International Space Station today.
Wow.
That's actually not true.
That really is true.
That is true. Well, Brian's not here for the intro and the outro. He had to take off a little bit early, but he is here for the most important parts of the show, which is all the segments. Jeremy, what are we going to talk about?
One of the things we're going to talk about this episode is some of the things that have recently happened at the Wikimedia Foundation. You've had the executive director step down, some other people step down, and quite a bit of different things happening, so we're just going to discuss that in general.
Jeremy also reviews the WS-1001 Wi-Fi Observer weather station from Ambient Weather.
And we're going to talk about password managers. This was something that Stuart kind of raised. It was like, you know, he can't really find one that meets all of his ludicrous requirements. So are these things a good idea? Do we use them? And what are the best ones to use?
A thing being usable is not a ludicrous requirement. However, and we'll also be talking to Josh Strobel of the Solus Project, who are a Linux-based operating system. I'm finding out what the deal with it is.
And now, with 100% chance of sun, bad voltage.
Well played.
As of late, much has been happening over at Wikipedia, or Wikipedia's parent company. Is that the right word? Parent company? Wikimedia? Is it just the company that makes a product called Wikipedia, or is it like a parent company?
It's the foundation, I believe. Yeah.
It's the foundation.
It's the Wikimedia Foundation, right?
It's the Wikimedia Foundation. A lot's been going on there, so it kind of seemed like a good time to chat about it. Now, not too long ago, the executive director? Is that what her title was?
Yes. I think it was
the executive director left Wikimedia. We tried to get her on the show. No go. I never got a response back. So we reached out to the folks over at Wikimedia to see, well, you know, what's happening over there. Is stuff seems to be going on. There's stuff related to search. There's some people who have some concerns about some of the editing rules and whatnot over it on Wikimedia or Wikipedia. So let's talk about it. Never got a response back from anyone at Wikimedia within their media department. And so we're just going to talk about it, not knowing anything about the inside of Wikimedia or Wikipedia, because they wouldn't frigging even talk to anybody. So this kind of brings up some interesting things. Where do we start with this? Do we have bad breath?
I think we know a little bit, right? A lot of it stemmed from the whole Knowledge Engine thing, which after that happened, they got a grant from the Knight Foundation. People in the Wikimedia community asked for a little bit more information about what exactly the grant detailed. Yep. And it turned out that it was part of the problem is it kept changing, right? First, it was a full-fledged competitor to Google. And then it was really just a search engine for freely licensed works. And then in the end, they said, no, it's not any of that. We're just improving our existing search infrastructure, which is obviously three vastly different things.
But yeah, those are very different things.
I think the core of that one was the lack of transparency. So then the board member, one of the community elected board members stepped down. And then obviously Lilla, the executive director, stepped down. And during all that, Arnon, which was one of the new non-community directors, was forced to step down, I guess. He was part of that whole Google suppression thing.
I couldn't figure out any details on that. It seemed really
so
vague.
There's a whole bunch of disparate things I think happening there, and it seems odd to me because you know you have a foundation that was founded in a very open, very transparent way, now seemingly not being very transparent in a lot of ways.
I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, I don't have personal experience of this, but there's always been this set of stories, accusations, whatever, that hover around Wikipedia, that it's supposed to be this big, open, democratic thing, and actually it isn't. and it's kind of run with an iron fist by a small cabal of the elected, you know?
Yeah.
And
I like that you managed to choose all the evilest sounding words along that line.
I'm just looking for a neutral description of what's going on. A lot of that rhetoric is coloured by the way this is presented, because the only people who talk about it are people who feel that they've been cut out by the secret Wikipedia cabal. And it's hard to tell whether this is sour grapes on their part because they weren't allowed to edit pages.
So do you mean Wikipedia or Wikimedia, though?
Well,
what's the difference? I don't even understand.
Well, that's part of the thing.
I think you have to separate the Wikipedia editing community from the Wikimedia Foundation overall.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
This sounds to be more of the
run by Jimmy Wales, right?
No. Well,
the community is much more.
It's more of a community, you know. It's like comparing Canonical to the Ubuntu community. There's an organization that's funded, and then there's just the community that's involved.
Right. And I would say that, I mean, Ak is right in the fact that there has been for a long time various like rumblings within the Wikimedia community where people are grumbling about how it's operating in different ways. But there've always been like. From what I've seen, it's always been the level of usual grumbling in any kind of open community, right? There's grumbling in every open source or open free culture community.
Sure.
And it's never really stepped above the surface that much. This thing seems to be much more of a, you know, the organization, Wikimedia thing.
Well, I mean, I think part of that, though, is exactly as you said, Jeremy. I mean, it started off as being, you know, it's going to be a replacement for Google. And they went, no, it was never that at all. It was just we're going to improve the search engine on the website. But it's difficult to tell from the outside whether it really was never that at all or whether they actually did want to do some kind of thing for Google.
Well, they finally did release the grant after much grousing, and it's certainly worded substantially more like the former than the latter.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. It's at least possible to come to the conclusion that what happened was they had this big plan, it got leaked, everyone mocked the shit out of them for it. They went, no, it was never that at all, right?
Right.
It looked like face-saving rather than actually correcting the record.
I think a lot of people in the community would have been fine with them saying we're competing with Google and then competing with Google. I think the secrecy is what more got under a lot of people's skins, at least from my interpretation of the events.
Yeah, from what I read, you know, a bunch...
Yeah.
From what I read, some documents were leaked on a mailing list, and people were primarily annoyed with the fact that, an organization that prides itself on transparency was not operating in that capacity, and people were calling for her resignation, right? It sounds like she didn't just voluntarily...
No,
she probably stepped down. It sounds like people were... Like, there was a...
Well,
there was
a whole bunch of people quit. Dozens of people quit. And they had internal survey. Right. 7% felt informed and 10% felt confident in senior leadership. Which
you
have a worse approval rating than the U.S. Congress. You're struggling.
you do slightly get the impression that it wasn't even... People weren't even annoyed that there was a secret discussion being had. It's that there was a secret group having the discussion in the first place. It's not like, you know, the conclusions you're coming to are secret. It's that there's a little bunch of you who are going away and talking about secret stuff, and we weren't even invited. We didn't even know there was a part of it.
Yeah. And this is not a new thing, right, in the open source world, because there's always been tension between the commercial backer of a project and the project itself.
Yeah. Yes.
And I'm curious to see what I'd love to know, and I don't know this, maybe you guys do. I'd love to know what that tension looks like on a typical day-to-day level, outside of the specific case, because, you know, every company, here's the thing, like every company or every foundation behind a project is always going to have more information. You're always going to have that. You can never avoid that.
Sure.
There's always going to be certain things that you can't share with the community. It's just the way it is. But then there's like, I think most people in communities kind of get that.
You know,
you're always going to have some people who are always going to be deliberately argumentative when, you know, when it isn't 150% transparency. But I'm curious to see, like, if this is an endemic thing within Wikimedia, or whether it's just this thing, and this is primarily driven by a bunch of people
judging by the amount of people that quit, it seems endemic.
It's a big deal.
All the things that multiple disparate people said in different departments across the organization, it seems endemic. But I also
doesn't look
good. Yeah, it doesn't.
If you do a thing and half of your team quit, then it's got to be, you know, an unusually large kick in spots, right?
Right. And I think Jono's right. A lot of times there is, you know, some tension between the commercial backing entity and the community. That happens all the time. But usually, like, if we're talking about Canonical or SUSE or Red Hat, if they ever do anything, even if it's totally for the good of everyone, but they just fail to communicate it properly to the community, they get reamed for it. Whenever Canonical or SUSE or Red Hat, and usually all three of those companies usually try and do really good things for their communities. And just sometimes they fail to communicate one tidbit or something from a board meeting or something like that. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
But whenever it happens, both the company usually tries to make a point of communicating overly much to compensate, and the community roasts the hell out of them within 4 minutes of any indication that something like that might even happen. And yet what we're seeing with Wikimedia and Wikipedia, it's something way beyond that. It's not just that there's a little bit of non-communication or secrecy or something like that. It seems so far beyond that. Yeah.
So here's
I was just going to say two things. Whenever I see things like this happening, having worked for a company who, has had particularly I learned this at Canonical, like having worked for a company that has a community and knowing that you can't always share information or certain decisions make more sense when you've got the context that you've got within the company. I always see these kinds of news stories and think there's always another side to this story. There's always another side that we're not aware of. And I have a certain amount of sympathy towards that. With this, it seems particularly bad, I have to say. But then the other thing, I think part of the reason why we haven't seen a lot since this happened is, Wikipedia are a global brand, right? They're a global thing. This is not like, they're way bigger than any of the, than Canonical
they're
or
SUSE. Bigger than the
Red
Beatles,
Hat.
Man.
And so I can imagine for companies with that level of brand recognition, like they will have professional PR people that will immediately lock them down. And I can imagine that there's been a ton of internal discussion here and there about we don't want to prolong the news cycle, but we absolutely know we need to respond in some way.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult situation. Even just at a small level, we had a lot of that at Canonical. And I can only imagine what it must be like for Wikipedia.
But I think an open source foundation should not be having a PR department whose gut response is, let's lock this down. This isn't...
I agree.
You know,
but
McKinsey
right.
that we're talking
wouldn't surprise
about.
Me if that's the case.
Yeah. I shouldn't do that, but I ultimately probably do.
We seem to have a situation here where we had an open source foundation started very well intentioned, pretty transparent, I think, that has seemingly become very, very not transparent. But I think I see a lot of parallels here, not to the extent maybe, but a lot of general parallels to what happened at Mozilla, where you had a very large, very open, very transparent organization, very community driven, that has since gotten much less community driven. I would even go as far to say is out of touch with the community in a lot of ways in Mozilla's case. Why are we seeing very well-intentioned open source foundations that have done a ton of good for the community suddenly forgetting what they are and acting in a way that shouldn't be who they are? Why is this seeming
money?
You think that's all? Is you think it's that simple?
I don't actually. If you look at Mozilla, for example, you look at Canonical. You look at I'm guessing for Wikimedia, we don't know because it's hard to say. But for most of those companies, the conflict comes about when Jono says there's always going to be things you can't tell the community, right? That's not necessarily a rule.
So let's take Canonical
universe.
Out of it, because Canonical is a company whose goal is to make money and be an organization predicated on making money. That's what companies do. That's not what foundations do.
Right.
That's not the end goal of foundations.
But they still want to make enough money to become sustainable, of course.
But there should not be a profit motive, which changes the dynamic. I understand. And it depends on what kind of foundation and et cetera, et cetera.
There is a business reality to running foundations as well.
There absolutely is a huge... Absolutely. If you're not sustainable, then you go away and then your mission is zero.
But I think the point you're saying, Jeremy, is that there is an obligation of transparency with foundations, whereas there isn't necessarily that with companies.
But it doesn't matter whether you're trying to make enough money to keep the good works of the foundation going, whichever you are, or you're trying to make all the money in the universe so you can jump into it like Scrooge McDuck, right? The point is, the instant you start doing deals where you're trying to make money. You're then interacting with a bunch of other companies who do not share your transparency goals and will say, no, you absolutely can't talk about that. You're under NDA. Right. This is all secret. We're doing an announcement. So the instant you bring in that kind of thing, and no one does deals like that for any reason other than money. It's always
it is.
Because you're trying to make money, and then the we must be transparent comes massively into conflict with we're not going to do that because you're interacting with people who don't share those goals, or you'll screw up the chance of the deal if you talk about it before it happens.
No, you know, Stuart, that is a very good point. I think what it comes down to for me is not so much the simple transparency of a foundation because it's a foundation, more of the severe and humorous irony of having a foundation all about open and collaborative knowledge being secretive. I mean, it's if it doesn't fit into an Alanis Morissette song about irony, I don't know what does. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's crazy.
I think the thing is, as well, is I don't think it's so much about money. I think the main reason why some of these foundations change is it's to do with scale and public recognition. Because what happens is you grow to a certain size, just in terms of people, it becomes hard to run a company or a foundation. And then secondly, I think when you become like a household brand, of which Mozilla and Wikipedia have both become many cases, you get to a point where you become more of a target in the press, and I think you then start hiring PR people who can deal with that level of public attention, and their gut reaction is going to be to reduce news cycles and to cut things down. It is at odds in many cases with the typical kind of open source methodology of being completely open.
Because
I don't think it's so much the money.
Because the instinctive reaction is that the way you make sure your brand looks good is by meticulously controlling every time it's ever mentioned.
Right. I mean, the reality is, Jono's totally right. Jono's totally right on this one. He's right. It's not just money. If these organizations are getting large enough to need to hire a lot of PR people, the people they're hiring are probably not from the open source community, because there's not that many marketing people in open source. I mean, sure. I think this podcast represents a significant percentage of the marketing people that exist in the open source world. And so there's just not that many people to hire. So they're getting people from Microsoft. They're getting people from Nike. They're getting people from Coca-Cola. And they're getting people who came from an entirely different world with a different mindset. And so it's going to have a distinct impression and change on how they communicate externally.
There is, I think, a second reason. I said, you know, it's all about money, and to some extent I stand by that. But there is another reason why you wouldn't necessarily want to have the community involved in all your decisions, which is that the community are a pain in the arse. And they're wrong about a whole bunch of stuff, and they shout about a whole bunch of stuff, and they're ungrateful and annoying and tedious.
Community management job, aren't you?
I'm absolutely going to quote you on that, Stuart. That is fantastic.
I don't think it's a matter of the community being involved in every decision, right? I think it's a matter of the community understanding the decisions you're making and clearly articulating why those decisions are made.
I don't think so at all.
You can make as many decisions that you want, but you should make them in a transparent
I don't agree with you. I think that's how we would like communities in general to work, and I think in practice it absolutely is not like that. If you make a decision and they weren't consulted and listened to and get their way, you get vilified.
Well, I think a very vocal minority, though.
I don't think it's as extreme as what Ak is saying, but I think what he's touching on here is when these shitstorms do kick off, I think what does happen in companies and foundations is, for the people who are not intimately familiar with how the community operates and understand that this is just another day at the farm in many cases, it makes other people trigger shy. It makes executives trigger shy. It makes PR people trigger shy about wanting to reach out to the community because you worry that something's going to happen. You know, and I'd say the other thing as well, particularly for really big companies, and I would probably put Wikimedia within the context of this, there's legal risks. Like you're at risk all the time of being sued because you're a big household name. And that is also going to, I mean, you know, when there's legal issues on the table, invariably it quietens external communications as well.
Right. regular listeners will know, I'm an avid runner and sports fan. Adding the fact that I live in a city where weather can change in an instant, and a personal weather station was irresistible to the tech and data enthusiast inside me. After doing a bit of research, I decided on the Ambient Weather WS1001 Wi-Fi Observer. Up front, I should state, while it only needs to be performed once, setup is a little bit involved. The product comes with three components: an outdoor sensor array which should be mounted on a pole, chimney, or other suitable area, a small indoor sensor, and an LCD control panel slash display console. The first step in setup is to mount the all-in-one outdoor sensor, which remains powered using a solar panel and rechargeable batteries. It measures and transmits outdoor temperature, humidity, wind speed, wind direction, rainfall, and both UV and solar radiation. Next, you mount the indoor sensor, which measures and transmits indoor temperature, humidity, and barometric pressure. Finally, plug in the control panel and complete the setup procedure, which will walk you through configuring your Wi-Fi network, setting up NTP, syncing the two sensors, and picking your units of measurement. Note here that all three devices must be within roughly 100 to 330 feet of each other, depending on layout and what materials are between them. With everything set up, data will now start collecting on your display console and is updated every 14 seconds. In addition to showing all the data previously mentioned, you will now also see wind gusts, wind chill, sunrise, sunset, phases of the moon, dew point, rainfall rate, and some historical graphs. As you can probably tell, there is a ton of data presented here, and while the sparse, dense layout works for me, it has been described as unintuitive and overwhelming by some. While seeing the data on the display console in real time is interesting, you'll likely also want to see some long-term trends and historical data. While the device can export all of its data to an SD card in CSV format, it becomes much more compelling when you connect it with the Weather Underground personal weather station network. Once connected, the unit becomes a public weather station that also feeds data to the Wonderground prediction model. That means you'll be helping everyone get more accurate data for your specific area and better forecasts for your general area. You can even see how many people are using your personal weather station to get their weather report. There's also a very slick Wonder Station app that is a great replacement for the somewhat antiquated display console, although unfortunately it's currently only available for the iPad. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? At $289, the Ambient Weather WS1001 Wi-Fi Observer isn't cheap. And in an era of touchscreens and sleek design, it's definitely not going to win any design awards. That said, it is a durable, well-built device that transmits and displays a huge amount of data. The Wonderground integration really is seamless, and knowing that you're improving the predictive model for your neighborhood is surprisingly satisfying. If you're a weather data junkie, this is a great device for you.
So you spent $289 on a weather thing
that I gotta
that connects
say
to your Wi-Fi.
Is a great bargain for what you got, my friend. Amazing. That's awesome.
I didn't think about it, well spent for all that it does.
You didn't want to just hire 289 homeless people to stand outside your window and shout in what the weather's like.
Well, wait, this isn't Birmingham.
They're not everywhere.
Well, hold on a second. I don't know how much your British homeless people cost, but here in America, homeless people cost at least like $10 to do stuff like that. So, you know, whatever.
Trump making America great.
So the interesting thing, if you actually want to get a weather device, is there are some cheaper ones, like the Natamo is a fair amount cheaper, maybe $100 cheaper, and very slick looking, but you get way less information out of it. And then from there, you get like the Davis, the Vantage View is a fair bit more, hundreds of dollars more expensive, and doesn't do a ton more. It does do some more, but this is kind of the sweet spot right in the middle where it does a lot. It's well designed.
The impression I have with this thing is it thinks of itself as kind of a pro level tool, right? It's not designed to be some kind of slick Nest like, look, it's an Internet of Things thing in your house. It's like, this is a weather station for scientists. Yes.
It's definitely a hobbyist device. You know, I think they're aiming at schools and people that are really into weather data and stuff like that. The display console thing is so antiquated that it is not an Internet of Thing anything.
I have to say, though, much as when I heard the review, I thought this is absolutely ridiculous. Like when you first said, let's review a weather station, I was thinking, all right, this is going to be one of those LCD panels that you base, those $10 LCD panels that you basically glue to the side of your house. The fact that it is connected to your Wi-Fi, I find instantly attractive. Like, you take anything and you connect it to a network, it becomes instantly interesting. You know,
you are the cancer which is killing the internet.
Right? You are destroying it all for us, Jono.
I think it's actually quite cool. It's one of those things where I will never be able to justify this to Erica.
On a more serious point, it collects a whole bunch of data, and that's good. And you're feeding that upstream so other people can see it, which is a very nice public-spirited thing of you. But why do you care about this data that much? I mean, why is it useful to know exactly how much wind chill there is?
So, like I said, I think it was oddly satisfying after I set it up to know that if you now go to Wonderground, which also feeds up into Knowing, some of the bigger ones, and look for the weather at the Buffalo Zoo, you are getting the information directly from me. Like, that, I think, is a pretty cool thing. And it makes the general forecast for Buffalo better, which I think is also a pretty cool thing. Like I said, I'm a kind of a data guy at heart. And because weather plays such a big part in so many things I do, you know, Buffalo is on the Buffalo River and Lake Erie. So boating and water sports are a big thing here. Football games and hockey games, I like to run. So weather impacts a significant portion of what I do. And that's outside of the fact that in the winter, 1 mile away, they might get 3 feet of snow and you can see my front yard. So weather here is kind of a big deal.
Improving that in such a seasonal place.
Yeah. Yes.
It's not like out here in California. Like 90% of the year, it's the same
way. I don't think you need this because you just say, 78 and sunny.
Right.
Just like yesterday.
Being around the Great Lakes is different. Yeah, it really screws with stuff.
I appreciate this. Yeah, and absolutely. Weather's an important thing in what you do. But the device doesn't look into the future. It tells you what the weather is, not what it's going to be. So what do you do with the data once you've got it? Do you feed it into some other software which predicts stuff, or do you just do it all by hand?
No, but like I said, all of the gauges feed into the Wonderground predictive model for the area. So the more of these that are installed, the more data collection points they have to then do their forecasts and make better predictions on their end.
Kind of think of it like the SETI project. It's like a distributed SETI project, except for weather. You're taking part in science. You are helping push science forward in this regard.
But I don't know a lot about weather, but I was under the impression that weather stations have enough data. The variance in the quality of the prediction is less to do with the data that they're getting. It's more to do with the inefficiencies of the predictive model. Like that, you know, there's only so far you can go in predicting weather.
So the newer prediction models, especially like they always talk about the European prediction model, the more data points you have, it will get more accurate a point, obviously. It's not going to get vastly better if a bunch of people get these. It might get a tiny bit.
Not every house on your block needs to have one of these, but the more you have throughout your given city, the more detail you have about the weather. I actually wanted to point this out to Jono. You've got a kid, Jono. Get them excited. I mean, granted, the little guy's young still, but you know, so my daughter's five and, you know, starting now and over the course between she's now and like, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, this sort of thing starts to get more interesting when we're talking about types of clouds and weather patterns and the like. I can get one of these suckers and say, this is what it's doing right now at our backyard and point out like how it affects everything else and where the wind's coming from. And you can say, look, it's raining right now 3 miles to the east of us. When do you think it'll rain at our house if the wind is going at a certain speed? And you can use it as sort of an educational thing to get the kids excited.
That's
not in California.
I like that, because that gives me a reason to justify
it. I'm here to help you, my friend, because that's what I'm going to use to justify this.
Spending. Because she's going to say, you want to spend how much on a weather thing? Can't you just look out the window?
hey, Jack, look. See, here's the weather. It's 23 degrees and sunny again. Would you believe it?
Jono, so you're having a hard time to justify that, but you have no problem justifying a watch that tells you you went for a walk today. Just to be clear, there's the differences.
But that's
okay. Jeremy.
That's fitness. That's different.
Jeremy.
That's making me stick around longer.
Jeremy. I have to ask, Have you been able to resist the temptation to really fuck with the data, to like go out there with like a squirt gun and like a bowl of ice and just really mess with things? Because I don't know that I could. I mean, I'd want to resist, but I don't know that I could.
I haven't, although it is funny.
Blow really hard on it and just to see if you can like make the wind speed go up.
There's two of these on my street and about five in my, you know, my neighborhood's maybe about 5 blocks by 8 blocks, a little community called Parkside. There's two on my street, five in the community. The one on my street is so far off. So the other ones, and you can't really see the brands or anything when you log in. So I don't know what kind of device that it is.
Yeah.
But it's so far off the rest of them. I do want to go mess with his or hers.
Oh my God, this thing says it's like, raining beer in Buffalo. What the hell is going on?
Right. Everyone's else will say, you know, 68, and that one will say 47 or something. It's so far off. And they'll say there's like 50 mile an hour wind. So I don't know if he sits out there with a fan or something.
Right.
That actually raises an important question, though. I mean, how do they make sure that the data is authentic? I mean, I'm assuming that they're averaging
so
out.
So you get a notification if yours falls outside of certain variants of the other ones in the area. It actually will kick it offline and tell you there's a problem with it. So I'm assuming his is not going into the predictive model.
Right. Because it's all cool. Lies. So a software-y question then. You said that it's a big pain to set up and you've got to set up NTP on your network and all that kind of thing. The software on it itself, is it open source?
No, you don't set up NTP on your network. It just uses the NIST network. The part that's kind of a pain is the device is very specific in where it has to be. It has to face north. It has to be a certain amount of feet above any obstruction. So actually mounting the thing is not trivial, especially if you're not very handy. So it definitely involves either drilling into your porch if you have one upstairs or going on top of your roof and putting it on the chimney, which obviously is even more involved.
Is the software on it itself and the software that it talks to and everything, is that open or is it something that that has to come from these weather station people? What happens if they stop updating it, etc.?
You can buy software for it, but that software is not open source, and I believe it only works on Windows. It might just have started working on Mac. Definitely doesn't work on Linux.
Firmware
on it is also not open. So all the software is embedded in that control panel, which was probably written in the 80s from the look of the interface.
Dude, this is awesome.
Interesting.
This is awesome.
I mean, if you are a data guy and a weather guy, it is a lot of money, but it is pretty cool.
It's not that bad. I mean, for what you get, it actually seems like a pretty good deal to me. I don't know.
Are you now like a weather nerd? Are you going to like weather user groups and talking about cumulus clouds and whatever else? Like,
have you been hanging out
on forums?
I have not.
Because I imagine like you set this thing up and you're like, this is really interesting. I'm playing a role in a bigger weather predictive market and blah, 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 blah. And then you set it up and then a week later you've forgotten about it. Like, how long have you been using this thing for?
So I've probably had this one for, I don't know, about 9 months, maybe. I think I installed it last summer. So I've had it for a while. And like I said, because I check the weather and I use Wonderground, every time I check the weather, I'm in effect using it. I will say it's not something I haven't looked at the display panel in months just because I don't need to, because you can get that information elsewhere. Yeah, but
excellent.
Cool. So there you go, weather nerds. If you need a necessarily complicated Wi-Fi attachment. By the way, one person that I think is going to be very interested in this is Matthew Garrett, because I'm sure he's going to buy one of these and try to hack it, because that's what he seems to do. Like, he went out and bought the barbecue Wi-Fi controller thing that I've got for my smoker with the only intention of hacking it and seeing what it was running.
Right. So he does do that quite a bit. You see him reverse engineer the one hotel that he was in?
Yeah. That's actually an interesting question. Have you looked at whether it bothers to talk to Wonderground securely or anything?
Securely?
I have not.
What's it going to steal your credit card information because it can tell where the wind is blowing? I mean, what?
No, but I am kind of curious. I will actually look at that now, yes.
So now on the show, we've got Josh Strobel, who is the communications manager for the Solus project. Now, first of all, hello, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Well, great to have you on the show. Now, Solus is an interesting thing. There's lots of Linux distributions around and lots of different desktops around. You know, there's Ubuntu and there's the stalwarts Ubuntu, Fedora, SUSE. And then there's newer ones like Elementary. And Solus is very much of a newer, kind of easy to use distro. Can you just tell us what it is and what the main goals of it are.
Sure. So Solus is a Linux operating system, of course, that is built from scratch, and it's developed and optimized strictly for the desktop.
Strictly for the desktop. So just to be clear, you don't have these grand ambitions where you're going to be on every phone and TV and toaster on the planet kind of a thing?
We're not aiming for convergence or, touch optimized usage or something. So.
Right. It's just cool. Desktop. Just focus on the desktop. So why, I guess the main question that people who listen to this are going to have, who haven't gone and looked at it, looked at the screenshots and looked at the website, why should our listeners care about it? Why would they be interested in Solus as opposed to Elementary or some of the other newer desktops?
Right. So, the key differential is that we are built from scratch. And the reason we're built from scratch is because we want to do very targeted optimizations that wouldn't necessarily be achievable if you're using maybe a tier 2 or tier 3 distro like Ubuntu or Elementary. So it puts us more in line with other operating systems that are tier 1 like Debian, but
right.
We are less generic in that we're specific for the desktop. So
now let's dive into this a minute, because I find this fascinating, because almost all the distros out there are based on Debian or based on OpenSUSE or based on Fedora. How from scratch are we talking here? Are we talking like Linux from scratch style, from scratch, like package management and the whole works? Like how from scratch?
That's one question I had that I'll dovetail on that is, aside from being from scratch, you guys use a different package manager than almost any other distro. It's based on one that from a previous distro. But with all the work that something like apt and dpkg gets, or yum, DNF, and RPM get, what went into you guys selecting your own package manager? Because I think that's interesting.
Yeah, so there's a little history behind that. So for EO package specific, which is the package manager we use, it is actually originally a fork of PC from Pardis Linux. But it has diverged significantly since then. I guess the key differential is we don't really care a whole lot about the package manager, because the idea in the end is not to use a package manager to begin with, is to be able to do everything without having to say do EO package search and then for a file.
What's your installation process like then for installing packages?
Yeah, so we do ship a software center, and it's getting a little bit of love this cycle, thankfully. So you can just do a traditional search for a package or software like LibreOffice through the software center and download it through there.
Nice. So how do you... Okay. I'm totally on board with that, and I actually think that sounds kind of cool that you guys are really mavericking it up and going your own route. How do you deal with things like the fact that so much software is already prepackaged for a Debian or RPM-based distribution? How do you combat that? Do you provide a way for people to get a Deb or a .rpm or something like that onto your system, or do you just focus on the ones that you provide in your own repository through your own package management system?
So to put it in perspective, a year ago, we were able to fit the entire repository on a 20 gigabyte hard drive. And now we've expanded to multi-terabytes for a repository alone.
Nice.
So we have expanded quite significantly since then. But for things like Chrome and Spotify, we do have alternative methods for obtaining those proprietary software. Of course, you can't ship those in a repository just because of distribution policies. But we do provide fairly easy methods for installing Chrome and Spotify in this very Hangouts plugin we're talking through.
When you say fairly easy methods for those things, are they specific? So in order to enable Chrome, did you have to do a little thing to make Chrome possible and then a separate little thing to make Spotify possible? Or when you say we do provide methods to do this, can I install anything that way?
So we don't provide any sort of magical handlers for installing Debs or RPMs. We do have a third-party GitHub repository where we do have very specific tailored scripts for installing Chrome and Spotify.
Right. So if I want something, if I'm using Solus and I want something that you haven't yet done the setup for, if I come along and say, okay, I'd like Steam, or I'd like, I mean, you might have Steam, but I'd like DraftSite or I'd like Skype or whatever, something that isn't on your list, do I then have to be a Linux expert or file a bug and wait for you to solve it for me? Or can I actually do that?
Well, I mean, thankfully, packaging on Solus is very easy. It's just a matter of doing some YAML syntax. And we do actually have a YouTube series that you could watch and follow along. So if you want to get into packaging, you could do that. You could also submit a bug. You can you could ping someone on IRC, and generally the issue could be solved very quickly.
Complain loudly on Twitter until someone fixes it for you.
Yeah, it's the open source way.
Yeah.
So the thing with, for instance, Skype is they love their 32-bit libraries. So actually, yep, this cycle we are focusing on enabling more 32-bit libraries, since we are oriented towards 64-bit.
Sure. Do you have a 32-bit version, or are you just 64-bit for the base system? Okay. I mean, most systems are going that way anyway, so that makes sense.
So one of the things I wanted to get into was, you have a Solus ships with a different desktop called Budgie. That's right. And Budgie, well, I remember when I first saw Solus, it was a little while ago, and someone posted, it may have been you, Josh, who posted something on Twitter or something, and I was like, that looks really cool. Like, looks really clean and simple, which I'm a big fan of. Like, you know, I think everyone here is a fan of some of the work that the Elementary team are doing, and what the GNOME team are doing. But it begs the question, we talk about this in open source all the time, like, why use something different? I mean, I'm assuming Budgie is from scratch as well, but why not, like, join forces with the Elementary team on their work? It seems like this is a desktop that tightly integrates with the GNOME stack, and it's got many of the common pieces, like a notification area, and it's very customizable. So maybe you could just share, like, what the vision of Budgie is, and also why it's Budgie and not something else.
Right. So, I mean, the idea behind Budgie was to create a desktop environment that is oriented towards a desktop workflow. So, and I could argue similar for GNOME Shell, but there is more, say, touch-oriented applications and touch-oriented interface tweaks that they do for GNOME Shell. But also, it's a bit more of a down, lower in the stack sort of thing. We want to prefer C as opposed to Vala. We want to do specific tweaks to...
Ooh, a Vala dig. The Vala guys out there are going to go all crazy on you now. You know that, all right? You're going to get this flood of angry Vala devs.
Fortunately, there's six of them and they're all 13, so it doesn't really matter.
Okay. All right. All right. So, I totally get what you're saying. I totally do. Can you give me an example off the cuff of where, say, GNOME Shell is not well suited for a desktop workflow? Like a thing that you guys do differently that makes it a better workflow in Budgie?
Well, the first one off the top of my head is application switching. Of course, with GNOME Shell, by default, you have to go to the Activities pane and then choose an application on the left, assuming you don't have an extension installed for Dash to Dock. For Budgie, we have a more traditional yet modern feel. So you do have the applications listed on the top, whether it's an icon view or a task list view. And of course, you also have the ability to, say, manage your notifications and sound settings via Raven.
So, a slightly different question. I understand your reasoning for wanting to have full control over the experience, top to bottom. That's both valid and, I think, a good idea. But we've recently seen a whole bunch of things where it turns out that there's a reason that Red Hat and Canonical and SUSE have loads of staff. If you look at the Linux Mint thing, you can see them thinking, oh, that's why you have a full-time security person, is it? Ah, didn't realize that. There aren't that many people working on
Solus. Are you threatening to hack the Solus server, Stuart?
I absolutely am not.
Sounded like a threat to me. It sounded like you're going to take them out and post something really pornographic on their website. And I think it's upsetting.
The forums
I think this is yet another case of Brian LeDuc interpreting something bananas.
But on a semi-serious note, the Solus team isn't that big. how do you cover all of the stuff that a full-on distro needs to do, which you wouldn't necessarily need to do if you got to outsource that to someone else?
So specifically regarding security, we do have a lot of tools in place, for instance, CVE check tool. So we do get notifications regarding vulnerabilities in software almost immediately once they become public, and we patch them very quickly. So we do have a very quick process for handling security issues. We also deliver, for instance, GPG signed SHA-SOMs and SHA-SOMs without GPG signage as well. And we like to keep our WordPress up to date.
I think... This wasn't just specifically a security question. That's one thing, and it's great to hear that you've got you've got that kind of thing under control. Yeah. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff which doesn't feel like necessarily part of the core mission, but you've got to do it anyway. If you look at someone like Red Hat, they'll have full time people working on things like Pulse Audio to make sure the audio stuff works correctly when you plug in all manner of headphones, and they'll have people working full time on X or on Wayland or whatever. They'll have people working full time on the kernel. Do you surely haven't got a big enough team to have people work on all of this stuff, but all of that stuff seems necessary to me to write a full operating system.
Well, how big is the Solus like community, the active contributors to Solus?
So we've had over a dozen, at least a dozen individuals contribute packages, including the more common individuals, which is around 4 or 5. And then we, of course, have a full, like, 50-plus people that do constant testing and always raise their hand for contributing logs and stuff.
Nice.
And is the goal, this is just building on Stuart's question, but is the goal here that you want, instead of interpreting what the goal is, like, what is the goal here? Is the goal here that it becomes, the Solus becomes, like, you know, is the goal to compete with something like Windows or Mac, or is the goal primarily to be of interest to Linux users or something else?
The goal is to ship a viable Linux distribution for the desktop.
Viable. Okay. What does viable mean?
Well, there's obviously issues with market penetration for Linux on the desktop, if we're not talking about something like Chrome OS.
Right.
We want to provide a user experience where you don't have to do more Linuxy things like drop down the desktop, drop down the terminal, and say install specific patches for your drivers and mouse.
Very cool.
So you want a mainstream distributed desktop based on Linux is the goal,
right? We're here to build more or less a product as opposed to a niche operating system.
And are you wanting people to build apps like, you know, the elementary team are doing their own developer thing? I mean, they're using GNOME, a lot of GNOME technology behind it, but like I think probably with the exception of Fedora and SUSE, you've got Ubuntu want people to build Ubuntu apps, and elementary want people to build elementary apps. Are you wanting people to build Solus apps, or is it different?
So we focus on building applications using the GDK toolkit. So we don't do any special things like building on top of that with our own special toolkit. So we would prefer people contribute to existing GDK applications or GNOME applications to make the desktop entirely the desktop, no matter where you are, better. So
that's refreshing.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's kind of nice to hear that, you know. It's refreshing.
Nah, the flip side of that though is obviously part of the reason why the Linux desktop hasn't taken off is that it's massively fragmentary, right? You've got applications written in a bunch of different ways. There's very little consistency between them and so on. And I would have thought that a project looking to take top to bottom control of the experience and deliver something great would need to work on that kind of thing. If you just say to people, well, you know, I mean, you've got Inkscape and you've got LibreOffice, they work completely differently, but whatever, that's what they are. That doesn't seem to fit in with the Solus ethos of providing a consistent, great product.
Yeah, so obviously if we feel that a piece of software doesn't meet up to our standards, we're not afraid to rewrite it, for instance, with an entire desktop environment. But we also do a lot of tweaks, for instance, shipping Arc, the Arc GDK theme, and doing a lot of tweaks to some defaults for behavior for GNOME applications to make it more consistent across the board.
Very cool. Well, Josh, first of all, I want to thank you for coming onto the show. Secondly, I think it's really interesting what you're all doing. And thirdly, this has been, I think, in the history that we've done Bad Voltage, the meatiest interview. I can't think of a time when we've got so much, when we've been able to cover so much ground. So thank you for, you know, being quick and concise and giving us so much information, and all the best with the project.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I keep hearing people go on about password managers, right? About how they're going to, the things which store passwords for loads of different websites and apps and things, yes, that you use. And they seem, in theory, like a good idea. And I've tried a few out in the past, but I always end up finding them really annoying. Yep. Because you can't, I end up having to cut and paste things in and out of them, and then I forget to do it. Or I carefully randomly generate a bunch of passwords, store them in the thing, and then lose the file that they get stored in. So I now don't know my passwords for anything or whatever.
Right.
I would like to do this more, I think. So my question for you and for the community at large is using a password manager a good idea? Which one should I use? What are the downsides? Whatever.
So can I answer that with a question?
You said
you've tried some. Which ones have you tried?
Right. I tried LastPass.
Boo.
And I tried, I think, is it KeePass, but then there was KeePass 2?
And then KeePass X.
Right. I tried it. I tried the initial iteration.
.NET 4.
And I tried one called Pass, which is like a command line tool from the 1970s.
That was awesome.
That's hardcore.
I like that one.
But the major thing that I keep running into is that I would like integration of it to be completely seamless. So whichever browser I'm in or whatever, it just works. I don't have to switch over to the password manager and cut and paste the username and password from this thing into a browser. And I would like the same thing to work on my phone. There is no point.
So LastPass fulfills all of those things.
And I don't really want to be forced into using their service.
Yes.
In order to do the synchronization, because I'm worried about what happens when the company goes away. And there are an awful lot of companies who go, no, we provide the service, and that's what we do, and then they go away.
Or surely what happens is you just have to go and reset your passwords. It's not that big of a deal, dude.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's one that satisfies all those requirements.
I don't think there is either. You know, I mean,
there is
not. The difficult thing seem to be integration into browsers is considerably less slick than it ought to be. Syncing tends to require that you use their service. And integration into Android is shocking.
You could always go the everything in the Google ecosystem thing and make sure you always use Chrome for everything you do,
well,
and let
that,
Google know what all your passwords are.
One of the options is precisely that I use Chrome to do this. I would like integration into apps and both on my desktop and my phone as well. But that may be a bridge too far.
The kicker is the phone thing. So like when I joined GitHub, we use a password manager called 1Password, and I've heard various times. Yeah, and it's all right. It's not perfect, but it saves passwords. But I have to often do the, you know, go and cut and paste, you reveal the password and cut and paste it into the form and stuff like that.
So that's a pain in the ring piece. Why would anyone want to do that?
It is. And the problem as well is that, like, the syncing to the phone is clunky at best. So what happens is there's been more than a few occasions when, you know, I've had to log into a site for the first time and I've got this random collection of characters, and I've sat there and manually typed it in because it's going to save it on my phone. It is quite annoying. I've never used LastPass or the other ones just because, you know, I should, but I really don't. So I feel you.
My argument for how I want it to be before I'm prepared to use it is it needs to actually be as easy as my current policy, which is just setting all my passwords everywhere to be I love Brian. Right.
That is a good one, though.
Obviously, that's not very secure, even less secure now I've told everyone. But that's not very secure, and I'd like to fix the security thing, but I don't want it to get harder to do. Otherwise, we're doing the same thing where people say, well, you have to trade off some usability in order to get security, and that's a bullshit wrong thing.
Now, hang on a second. We've played this game before. Stuart Langridge has a technical requirement. If I'm correct, this is what happens. Stuart Langridge has a technical requirement with a series of very unusual attributes that cannot be satisfied. A blog post will be written in exhaustive detail asking the internet for their input. A solution will not be found, despite much protest from Langridge to suggestions. And then a bullshit Python script will appear on cryogenics.org aiming to solve said problem.
Ah, but so that only solves the problem.
Is going to appear out of nowhere?
The way these things work is the bullshit Python script just solves the problem for me. I'm not interested in trying to solve for everyone, because everyone comes back and goes, well, you've got weird requirements. I go, then fine. Then I'm not going to help anyone else solve their problem. I'm going to solve my problem specifically, and that's it.
Right. So the thing I think that's interesting about the question, should you use a password manager, is that there isn't an answer, right? It depends on what your tolerance for risk is, what your workflow is, kind of what your ideal worldview is. So for all non-technical people, I tell them to just use LastPass. And I tell them to use it for everything but their email and their bank, because it is absolutely better than the alternative, which is they're going to use ridiculous passwords like password 123. They're
going to
use
right
the same
that.
Password everywhere.
Yeah.
They're going to write their passwords down, and they're going to do so many stupid things that while LastPass is not ideal, it is substantially better than the alternatives for what they're going to do.
Yep.
So that's my advice, almost carte blanche to non-technical people. Technical people from there, I actually like Pass. I don't know, you seem like you're a little bit taking the piss out of it. It can use Git, it uses GPG, it does a lot of cool things. It is command line.
It does a very good job of keeping your password secure. It fails at every integration point imaginable, which is why I didn't like it.
Well, it doesn't have an its integration point is not having an integration point.
See, that's the whole point. I mean, that's really got to be what it is. I mean, so... if you're a technical person, I'm okay if you use a password manager, so long as it's not one of those password managers that is like LastPass, that basically just sends all of your data up to a cloud, up to a quote unquote cloud where someone else basically owns your data, where someone else controls your data, where you are at the whim of someone else to even get to your data. But other people are going to have more opportunities to steal your data than you could possibly imagine. So that to me is bonkers. If you would be a technical person that would do that, that's insanity. I'm not opposed to something like KeePassX or Pass and storing an encrypted like single database file or text file with your passwords and keeping it on like a private own cloud server or something like that. That I think is okay, because you're taking reasonable steps at controlling your own data and securing it. But I get what Jeremy's saying.
I think the way LastPass is implemented is fairly sound from a security perspective.
Is your data being stored by a company in a remote cloud that is theoretically accessible by those mean hacker people? Because if the answer is yes, then you got to say no.
The answer to that is I trust LastPass and any company predicated on security more than I trust your own cloud server by an order of magnitude.
I'm not necessarily worried about storing my data online as long as it's well encrypted. I mean, so Firefox Sync, for example, I have no problem with, because they do a good job of saying it's all encrypted on the client side. We've got the data in the cloud, but we can't look at it. We can't give it to anyone. We can give them an encrypted database file.
Right, as long as it's zero knowledge, they use good protocols, they use sound engineering.
But here's
the problem
with that.
I still use two-factor authentication, and I still don't store anything I consider important in it, but...
If I have my own cloud server that I don't publicize and I don't tell anyone about, if I have a file server somewhere, and on that file server is an encrypted database or file with my passwords, one thing... no one else knows about it. And sure, security through obscurity is not much in the way of security, but it's a step. It means that there is a if we all did that, then there's millions and billions of potential security targets for hackers to hit. It's not as interesting. We're not high profile. If you have a single LastPass server that you know has millions of people's passwords and personal information in it, that is one target that a group of people can focus on. Not only is that a singular target for a group of malicious people, like, you know, a hacker collective that just really wants to out Donald Trump's, you know, Ashley Madison password or something like that. Totally just pulled that out of my butt. I don't have any confirmation that he actually has one, but whatever. But it's also a single target for government agencies, for other companies who wish to sue them for data. All of these things happen all the time and are happening right now. And they're single points of access to that data. Removing a single point of access, a single point of failure, is a good thing in every single case.
I think that's fair comment, but I'm not sure there is a password manager which works in that environment. Well, I can say, okay, you've got an Android client which integrates into the Android browser, and you've got desktop clients which integrate into Firefox and Chrome.
You're right, there isn't.
Stores things on my own. So if there was one, I'd happily use it.
It doesn't exist. So you have to make the choice.
Right. If LastPass would let you run your own server, it would be ideal.
Do you give up security and control over your own data for ease of use? And this is a topic that comes up all the time, not just for password managers, but, you know, everything, where you store your email, all of it. And I think in this particular case, I think it's really, really critical.
And to my mind, I mean, like, you moved away from Google, fair play to you, absolutely, but you went to Colab for email, right? You didn't run your own mail server, because that's a pain in the ass.
It's a pain in the ass, yeah.
It is.
So I make compromises just like anyone else. You put all your eggs in one basket, just make sure it's a really good basket. I mean, I'm okay with the idea of trusting the LastPass people. I mean, it's possible you might get screwed on that basis, but they are, having done a bit of reading and so on, they seem to deal well with their users and their community. They seem to be open and friendly about how they work, and they have more security experience than I do.
How do you know they have more security experience? So are they running in a completely open source stack and encourage community audits of their server infrastructures? Do they
not
do that?
Not as far as I'm aware. But not
as far as I'm aware either.
No,
well, this is exactly it. This is a problem. That is an absolute problem. And for me, I can't. I'm just not comfortable with it. I'm supremely uncomfortable with the idea. It's kind of like going out and you have a key to your house, right? And you hide it somewhere in your yard. Like, you stick it under like the grossest rock in your yard. Is that secure? No. But hopefully no one will look there because, well, it's just one key and no one knows it's under the rock with a piece of dog poo on it, right? Now, what if everyone in your neighborhood decided, you know what? We're going to make a single wooden box with one combination. We're going to put it at the end of the street and label it all of our house keys. Everyone in the block put all their house keys in that box.
No way.
That's the worst analogy ever.
Really?
In the history of analogies. Show me why it's a bad analogy. Well, it's a single point of failure.
All of the data is encased.
Okay, make it a metal box. Make it a metal box with a code. Make it whatever kind of box you want. It doesn't matter. It's a single point of failure. It's a single point of easy theft. It's a single point of inaccess. And it's a single point of vulnerability. You make a single point and you put everyone's data in that point of failure, you've got a real problem on your hands.
Well, like, it definitely depends on what your tolerance for risk is and what your risk profile is, right? Because if a government agency is targeting you specifically, Brian Lunduk, they already have your Colab server and your own private own cloud instance they already own. So by own cloud, it means they own it.
So that's why it's
going. If you are worried about mass random attacks, then I would agree that single data point single,
that's more what I'm worried about.
It's definitely more alarming. So it depends on who you are and what you think your risk profile is. But that's why I think there's definitely no correct answer here. This is a different answer for everyone. I think, like I said before, the average non-technical person, it probably behooves them to use one of the well-integrated ones, even if that means they're... Because
I agree with you there.
Especially, don't store your banking information in it. Never store your email password in it. Because your email password basically is your password to everything. Because everything, you can reset your password via email. And so the very important things like that, I don't think you should store in any kind of service like that. But for all the rest of the services, I think for the average person, they probably make sense.
So, do you think you're going to start using Solus?
I'm kind of bizarrely intrigued by it. I quite like the look of it. I quite like the look of what the elementary people are doing as well.
Does Solus run a Mac? Owned by the also, Mac from two different directions.
And also, GNOME just released 3.20 as well, which is their new latest release. And I like the sheen that's going in there. Like, there's some exciting stuff going on in the Linux desktop world. I mean, no one's using it, but there's a lot of exciting stuff going on.
I think it's interesting, too, that most of the exciting new stuff going on is smaller, newer. It's none of the incumbents. It's none of the large corporations. It's boutique-y stuff.
I mean, my laptop runs elementary. I don't use it very much. I use the desktop, which is Ubuntu. But I've been playing with elementary. I don't know that I'd necessarily try Solus out, just because the concern I have with all these things is that they don't have a big enough team, right?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why on my Linux laptop I'm using GNOME, because they have a big team.
Yes.
Well, they have a bigger team, at least. Right. And I think what they're doing is really quite good. Like, you know, it's a much bigger kind of... It's a bigger vision that they've got. And I like the pluggability of GNOME 3. But yeah, I agree with you. So what's your elementary... Like, how are you liking it? Because I know you were going to... When you were over here for Bad Voltage Live, you were going to give it a shot. What did you think?
I did give it a shot. Not only did I give it a shot, they dragged me onto the Simply Elementary podcast and made me talk about it for an hour without pausing for breath. So
so just business as usual, then.
well, you know, I'm not saying it was a hardship. I'm just saying that it happened. It's interesting, actually. I think they've got the right idea, and I'm fully aligned behind a bunch of people who want to bring consistency and nice design and everything to it. They're quite good at punching above their weight in terms of having a small team and yet doing some quite good stuff. But a lot of that is because they outsource a lot of things. I mean, they're talking about a way of distributing apps, and it's backed up by GitHub, as an example,
right.
You know? And so there's a bunch of stuff like that where they're not saying, okay, we need this, so we need to sit down and build our own infrastructure and stuff, which on the one hand is, you could accuse them being short-sighted on that point. Because they're not actually taking control of the stuff that's important to their operating system. But equally, you can't, unless you're the world's first open source $2 billion company like Red Hat is, or you're being funded by a billionaire like Canonical is, or you're SUSE, it's not clear to me how SUSE get paid, then you've got to be able to, you've got to have a force multiplier, I suppose, right? You've got to be able to do more with a dozen people that you've got. It'd be interesting to see how Solus manage that. It was good the stuff you said about security as an example.
Well, because
people kind of left that out.
And when Dan Rabbit came on Bad Voltage, we basically leveled at him that, you know, like, they're going to need a lot of help to do this. They're going to need a lot of people involved. And we had the same... I mean, it's the same accusation that we can put at Solus, right?
You know, yeah. Well, Jeremy...
That's why I think they should just... They'll get behind GNOME. Just get behind GNOME, everyone. This is the right way forward.
Jeremy, there's a question. LQ would have done the regular poll of, you know, what Linux distribution are you using? How was the split in between what you might call mainstream distros, mainstream OSs, and boutique OSs? We count elementary, Solus, Rebecca Black Linux, whatever, as being boutique OSs, and Ubuntu, Fedora, SUSE, you know, the big old-fashioned names as mainstream. How's the split? Are most people mainstream people? Are most people boutique-y? Does the answer to the question depend on what you classify Mint as?
We have quite a few Mint users, obviously. We're a little bit skewed because we've been around so long towards older distributions. So Debian, Slackware, those have a higher prevalence.
23% of people on Linux questions using Yggdrasil Linux.
Stuff like that. So because of that, we're a little bit skewed. But no, we have a ton of Arch. We have a ton of, you know, pretty much everything. The amount of votes that we got in the last... the 2015 Member Choice Awards were all over the map as far as that. But I would say the majors have the most, unsurprisingly. But it's a pretty long tail.
Interesting. Well, we'll see what happens. I like the fact that people are trying new stuff, which is always good. And we like that. And we like to showcase that in Bad Voltage, which is always fun.
We do. I think before the show ends, we would be remiss if we didn't give our condolences to the folks in Brussels there. Very awful. Sad. Having just been there, I'm assuming you guys have both been there, correct?
Yes.
It's an awesome city. It's an awesome country. I always have a good time when I go to Belgium. Brussels is a great city. Very, very unfortunate what they're going through now. So our hearts and minds are with you all there.
Yes. The Bad Voltage heart is beating in the direction of Europe, specifically Belgium. And also, of course, you know, the continued grief that's happening in Paris. So it's a pretty terrible situation. I hope the governments of the world come together to rid the world of this scourge. So,
and to not end on such a down note, something we've been doing at LQ for a while is kind of we call it the LQ poll series, where every couple of weeks we'll post a new poll for the entire community to kind of join in on. And so I am going to start doing that for the Bad Voltage community. So if you head over to community.badvoltage.org, which is our forum, it'll be one of the top threads there. It starts with unoriginally Bad Voltage poll series. So the latest one I did is just the latest one we did over at LQ, which is what is the uptime of your main Linux desktop? And, Ack was actually the first person to jump in there. He just rebooted, so he's pulling the average down. So head over there.
It was 2 days. It's normally ages.
Looks like we got someone.
Yeah, it's looking interesting right now.
We got someone in the 364 day range. No one over a year yet. So head over there and let us know what you think.
Yeah. I'd love if someone is over 10 years. That'd be unbelievable.
We had one at LQ, but I'm not convinced that's true.
I don't believe for a moment anyone has a desktop machine.
I've definitely hit 3 years, I would guess.
What, on a desktop machine?
Probably close.
How did you upgrade the kernel?
A few years ago, I was using K-Splice.
Oh, hardcore tough guys who can do that, set up that kind of thing themselves. When they roll that into a stock Ubuntu release, that would be great.
It's upstream. K-Graft and the other one are upstream now, so it should be in all distros.
Yeah, but if it was integrated properly, then when I'd say install this, it wouldn't make me reboot.
Well,
right?
It just made it upstream, so probably not this. By the next LTS, I would imagine it'll be in Ubuntu.
I don't know. Next LTS is in less than a month.
No. I was not including. I was including that as this LTS, not the one that comes out in a week. the next one.
1804. Yeah, that should be fun. I mean, it'll be good when that happens, certainly.
All right. Should we maybe think about wrapping this up?
Yes. So go off to community.badvoltage.org and give your answers to Jeremy's polls. I think that's a good idea, actually.
It is. So consider it wrapped.